Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation and Corporations and Antitrust Practice Groups, was recorded on Friday, April 6, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing new legislation regarding beneficial ownership. My name is Michael Wallen, and I am the Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us David Burton, who is a Senior Fellow in Economic Policy at the Heritage Foundation. We also have with us Clay Fuller, who is an AEI Jean Kirkpatrick Fellow of Foreign Policy at the American Enterprise Institute. David Burton will start us off with remarks, and then Clay Fuller will follow. Afterwards, we will go to an audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us. The floor is yours, David.
Thank you. Let me just take a couple minutes and explain what these various proposed bills would do. And there's really three of them. They're all very similar with some minor differences. The first is the Corporate Transparency Act, introduced in the House by Congresswoman Maloney and in the Senate by Senator Wyden and Rubio. There's also Senator Whitehouse's True Incorporation Transparency for Law Enforcement Act, or TITLE Act. And then the third, and the one that I think we'll probably be focusing on, is the Counterterrorism and Illicit Finance Act, a discussion draft of which was released by Congressman Pierce in November of last year, and a hearing was held on the discussion draft on November 29th. There's also been a hearing in the Senate earlier this year, in February, I believe. So what the discussion draft and the other piece of legislation would do would be to impose on all corporations and LLCs a responsibility to report on their beneficial ownership. It would then exempt public companies, government-sponsored enterprises, banks, broker-dealers, exchanges, investment companies, insurance companies, and utilities, most tax-exempt organizations, and then probably most importantly, all businesses with more than 20 employees and gross receipts greater than $5 million. So what does that mean? That means that the only people really subject to the reporting regime are small firms with either less than $5 million in receipts or 20 or fewer employees. Now, the exemptions are not self-effectuating, and that's an important point. If you don't file the appropriate form with FinCEN under the discussion draft, then you will be subject to the financial and criminal penalties involved in the law. At first, it applies only to newly formed entities, but after 2 years, it applies to all corporations and LLCs and requires the information to be updated within 60 days. Now, let me walk through some of the other sort of issues. There are, it requires the beneficial ownership to be reported and then defines beneficial ownership in a very unconventional and, frankly, deeply ambiguous way. It uses language like directly or indirectly through any contract, arrangement, understanding, relationship, or otherwise exercises substantial control, and talks about substantial control as a practical matter, and then uses terms like substantial economic benefits. So it's not using beneficial ownership in the way we would use it in securities law or in corporate law. It creates its own massive set of ambiguities that we're expecting the smallest businesses in America to figure out. There's also some very poorly drafted look-through rules. If they don't have the look-through rules, then you could simply evade the act by having a two-tier corporate structure, but the look-through rules are a mess. But they also raise problems. Imagine that you're an entrepreneur with under $5 million in receipts or less than 20 employees, and a venture capital firm invests in your business. Well, then, as the entrepreneur, you're obligated to report, in effect, on the beneficial ownership of the venture capital firm. And the venture capital firm is probably exempt and may not even know its beneficial ownership. And in addition, you have no means of compelling the VC to give you that information. and the price of not doing it and then reporting on changes in the VC ownership within 60 days is that you're a felon. There are other difficulties with the way it was drafted. It consistently uses the term applicants. The term's not defined. It's also not a term that's ever used in corporate law when entities are being formed or in tax law or anywhere else. So imagine you're a church formed in 1900, incorporated. And the question becomes, who's the applicant? Who's going to go to prison if you don't keep up to date with defense and rules? Is it the pastor or the church treasurer? Then my estimate is that this will affect approximately 12 million businesses and churches, synagogues, mosques, whatever, that are corporations or LLCs. And if if we achieve only a 90% compliance rate, which is actually pretty high since most small business guys and church treasurers don't keep up with the latest in fence and money laundering rules, that's going to mean you have 1.2 million inadvertent felons made out of otherwise law-abiding people. Now, let's think for a second about the motivation here. I think the true motivation is to take care of the banks because there's a customer due diligence rule promulgated by FinCEN that takes effect on May 11th. And the legislation would place a temporary moratorium on that rule until it is rewritten consistent with the act. That, I think, is what's driving it. If you look at the list of organizations that support this, they're all financial institutions, banks, investment banks like SIFMA, the American Banking Association, the credit union, and so on. The list of people or organizations that oppose it consists almost of the entire rest of the economy, the U.S. Chamber, the manufacturers, the retailers, every small business group that's not an Obamacare front group, and so on down the line. So, but the problem with it is twofold. One, they should simply directly go after the rule and place a moratorium on the rule. To the extent there are problems with the rule, and I think there are, they should work with the new administration, place a moratorium on the rule, and then handle it that way. The other point is there's no reason to believe that FinCEN, who has historically showed very little interest in private sector compliance costs, won't just do what the British did, which is have the CDE rule and a beneficial ownership reporting regime. So it may not even help the banks. And what they're basically trying to do is impose a massive administrative burden on banks and the churches of the country to help the banks, and it may not even do that. More importantly, the way the bill is written, any money launderer or other person trying to engage in illicit finance with an IQ over 40 can avoid the rule. It only applies to corporations and LLCs. So through the simple expedient of forming a partnership or a business trust, you avoid the rule. If the look-through rules aren't written right, and they probably can't be without creating a revolt, then a simple expedient of a two-tier corporate structure will enable people to get around it. And then there's the illegal ways to get around it that are rather simple as well. You simply put your secretary's name down instead of your own, and you're good to go, because there's only $40 million provided to administer this entire system involving 12 million or more businesses and requiring updates in some cases several times a year. And $40 million in the federal government isn't very much money to administer something like that. So there isn't the resources to do anything like a regular audit. There will be no enforcement money. So this will be, in effect, a tremendous burden on law-abiding citizens, and will do nothing to further its stated aims of catching people involved in illicit finance. Lastly, there is a better way. All of this information that they're seeking is already available at the IRS. There are six IRS forms that provide even more information than the bill would require: the K-1s on 1065s, 1120Ss, and 1041s, also 1099 DIVs, and then the SS4 when you originally apply for your EIN, and the 8822B that requires people to update their responsible party information. With that information, the IRS could create a database that provides more information than the bill would have, more comprehensive information, be more useful to law enforcement, and allow them to do look-throughs when entities own an interest in entities. The only thing that we need to have to change is Section 6103, which are the privacy provisions allowing FinCEN to look at this information. There's already such information for other law enforcement agencies. The problem is the politicians don't want to do that because it's not within the House Financial Services jurisdiction. It's in a Ways and Means Committee jurisdiction. So again, because Congress can't get its jurisdictional act together, we're supposed to accept the imposition of this massive, complex scheme on the smallest businesses in America and religious organizations. And I just view that as unacceptable. So the long and short of it is that there's a better way to get this information to law enforcement if we want to do it. There's absolutely no need to impose these burdens on small businesses and the larger businesses that are exempt. And this will do almost nothing to aid its stated aims of countering illicit finance. So with that, I'll hand it over to Clay.
Thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me to this teleforum, and thank you to David for all of your hard work in this area. I do share some of your concerns outlined there, but as a foreign and defense policy scholar, I kind of take a very different approach to understanding this legislation. So in this sort of opening statement, I want to give a brief outline of my thinking on illicit finance in general, and then transition to my sort of particular views on beneficial ownership and this specific legislation. So to state it in a simplistic, or maybe not so simplistic, sentence, not sure that I trust the IRS to share data, but I like the House draft more than the Title Act. I think updating the anti-money laundering regime will actually maximize gains from efficiency by reducing regulatory burdens for banks, and it will increase competition among small businesses. And I support its passage mostly out of national security concerns. So to explain how I got to that, in graduate school, I studied mostly modern authoritarian states and how they survive in the global modern economy. So in the Economic Foundations of Authoritarian Rule, which was my dissertation, I argued that authoritarian rule by nature is based quite simply upon economic arrangements that are political in nature. Democracy, on the other hand, by design, is based upon institutional rules that secure individual rights and provide for independent arbitration of disputes. So in other words, authoritarianism in its character is opaque and violent, because it has fluid rules and has an absence of independent arbiters. Now, to get how this relates to beneficial ownership, in the post-Cold War era, Western democracies opened up their markets and actively sought out economic integration with authoritarian states. Many hoped, and some still do, that modernization theory would create middle classes that would turn around and demand democracy from these autocrats. Most, I think, in the West, saw new markets and opportunities to turn a profit. And that's good. The profits mostly came to fruition. But this integration with authoritarian markets, in my view, has morphed into a sort of messy entanglement, or essentially a rules-based liberalism entangled with opaque, violent, and economically-based authoritarian rule. Non-democracies simply just do not have a private sector like democracies do. Non-democracies simply cannot credibly commit to securing private individual rights like democracies can. It was a naive move, in my view. It was naive of us all to expect non-democracies to play by the same democratic capitalist rules of the West. But that's how we got to today. So now, with talk of renewed great power competition, I believe this great power competition will have its fights and battles in boardrooms, stock markets, trade wars, and giant swelling compliance departments, rather than anything that resembles a traditional battlefield or any type of arms race. Now, personally, I'm not sure if this is good or bad news, but it's reality. And the sooner we recognize it, I think the better we can craft policy and maintain our comparative advantage in this competition. With threats from Russia, Iran, North Korea, terrorism, transnational criminal organizations, and China, I see a common national security threat. Bad actors want and often need access to U.S. markets. Now, we dutifully allow them in, but we do so without stringent conditionality that they operate by the same democratic capitalist rules. In many cases, like good economists, we just assume that all actors have a mostly pure profit motive. But absent of the rule of law, as we understand its role in classical liberalism, authoritarian political economy is just plain different. Politics and economics are often indistinguishable in non-democracies. So actors with, let's say, an altered profit motive enter the U.S. market, right? This is good. New customers and producers are a good thing until we face some sort of negative externality. A negative externality, like, say, an opioid epidemic, a massive fraud scandal, or maybe a huge terrorist attack. Right, so the Bank Secrecy Act was passed in 1970 to limit the financing capabilities of the cocaine cowboys that were already here. The Patriot Act was created to expand tools in response to 9/11. Now, this sort of haphazard, ad hoc creation of anti-money laundering rules in the U.S. is riddled with loopholes. But you know what? I think this is actually fine. I think that the AML regime is simply a result of the founders' design of U.S. government, to prevent the government overreach. However, in today's global market system, which is unlike any the world has ever seen before, I feel like it may possibly be too dangerous to wait until the next giant negative externality, whatever it may be. It's too dangerous to wait until then to apply another patch. So the fact that foreign nationals can achieve anonymity and ownership through a wide variety of means is full stop dangerous. For example, the GAO recently reported that the General Services Administration cannot identify the beneficial owners of up to a third of high security leases. This means that a Russian oligarch could own the building that the FBI leases to investigate Russian oligarchs. Seems like an issue. Second, a recent investigative report uncovered that there are reportedly thousands of planes in the U.S., planes that are registered to shell companies known to provide services to non-U.S. citizens that we cannot identify the owners of. Planes transport drugs. It seems like this would be a big concern in the post 9/11 world. Third, there are renewed and new calls now to look into the use of anonymous companies in the financing of proliferation, which I'm sure compliance departments have heard about, called FOP. But most of the arguments against beneficial ownership are more economic and domestic. So my views there, I'm adamant that registries should not be made public. It should be available to law enforcement by subpoena or some other process. Individual rights such as privacy and property are what make our economy prosperous. They have to be jealously guarded. Second, the legislation should address and alleviate the cost of compliance for financial institutions and focus on increasing competition for small businesses. For financial institutions such as banks, compliance departments are not profit centers. They are net cost centers, and these costs get passed down to the consumer. Treasury customer due diligence rules, or the CDD, that come into effect next month, provide a clear definition of what beneficial owners are for banks and clear instructions on how to deal with complex structures. A less covered issue that doesn't get talked about is currency transaction reports, or CTRs, and suspicious activity reports, or SARs, have not really been updated since the 1970s. For instance, the amount for currency transaction reports today at $10,000 still has not even been adjusted for inflation. So law enforcement might not like the proposal in the House draft to increase the amount to 30,000 because that takes away some of their information. But I think this is a pragmatic move that will actually increase efficiency within private banks, law enforcement, and for consumers. Because outdated filing systems and rules for CTRs and SARs lead to protective and unnecessary filings that clog the system and cause many other unanticipated problems. They need to be updated. No one I know that looks at this stuff says we should abandon these. Beneficial ownership will actually help small businesses in the sense that it will likely push some politically and criminally motivated actors out of the legal market, creating less distorted competition among firms. So, for example, if you have small American shipping company X in small town Arizona, they have to turn a profit in order to pay their employees and stay open. Now, drug cartel shipping company Y, anonymously owned in the same town, has no need to turn a profit. All they have to do is not get caught. And in doing so, they can and they do swallow up other small, fair competitors. Second example, government contracts typically have set-asides for small business. Anonymously owned shell companies have a long record of defrauding the government by underbidding fairly competing small businesses for these contracts and then not delivering. One other issue is with data collection. Like I've said before, if Congress wants to try and legislate a way for the IRS to collect and share data, then they should, but I don't think this is a good idea, seeing how the IRS's mission is tax-focused and FinCEN's is national security. The argument that the burden of filling out a form is just too much to ask of a small business owner is just not realistically justifiable in my view. From my view, this line of argument is tantamount to saying that we shouldn't verify citizenship before handing out driver's licenses. The other argument, that this will cost an average $5,000 in attorney's fees to millions of small business owners, is relatively confusing as well. If this were true, I would venture to think that the American Bar Association would support the measure, but instead they are soundly against it. I understand concerns of attorney-client privilege, but this will always be a concern in all legislation. The argument that the legislation will create millions of inadvertent felons is also somewhat confusing to me. I'm not a lawyer, but I'm pretty sure that the knowingly and willingly clauses protect from this predicted dystopian future. Now, I agree that AML laws hurt poor developing countries, but that's not a valid reason to block these laws. De-risking by financial compliance departments is a real thing. But this is an area where the U.S. government can actually continue to lead the world in setting an example for other countries on how to run a modern AML regime and beneficial ownership in a pragmatic, limited way. I also agree with opponents that it is impossible to measure counterfactuals, that is, the crimes and disasters that AML laws have prevented. I agree that it is far easier to measure the instances where laws have failed, but this cannot logically be constructed as overwhelming evidence that they do not work. Beneficial ownership registries, if kept private, strike a pragmatic balance between the duty of government to provide the public good of national security and the privacy of private enterprise to produce private goods. It will maximize gains from efficiency in finance, business, and law enforcement. This, I believe, is the proper role of government, limited, balanced, and pragmatic. And I think that finding this proper balance in a bipartisan way with beneficial ownership is not only very possible today, but it is absolutely necessary for the economic strength and national security of our country. And I would ask David to please work with me in coming up with a solution that's acceptable in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you so much, both of you, for those opening remarks. It was very enlightening. David, did you want to respond to anything Clay said for a few minutes before we go into the Q&A?
Sure. I guess a couple of, there's probably nobody in this city more concerned about the sharing of tax information than me. I've spent a lot of time successfully so far in trying to stop, for example, the protocol amending the Multilateral Conventional Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters that's currently in front of the Senate and would share financial account information with countries throughout the world, including the Russians, the Chinese, the Pakistanis, the Colombians, and a lot of other people that are going to abuse the information. There is, on the part of tax authorities and folks like FinCEN, an utter lack of concern about the costs that are imposed, but also what governments they share the information with. And that needs to end. This is going to affect 12 million, at least, businesses. And as should be evident and would be evident to any of you who want to read the actual draft legislation, it's quite complex. It's not a simple thing to comply with. Even assuming that a small business owner can read, absorb, and implement these rules in an hour, then the cost to the economy is going to be $600 million. It's more likely that they will throw up their hands because even lawyers have difficulty figuring out what the various provisions mean and have to retain counsel. And by the way, that $600 million is pricing their time at $50 an hour. The odds are this is going to cost many billions of dollars to the private sector. There's a reason why the entire business community, except for the banks, oppose this. And, you know, Clay can make light of that, but the bottom line is this is going to be a massive new regulatory burden on the smallest businesses in America. And it does target the smallest businesses in America. And Clay, in his op-ed in The Hill, said that's precisely what he wants to do, to target the smallest businesses in America. And, you know, I may be mistaken, but I do not think that the dry cleaners and Main Street shop owners of America pose the largest money laundering threat in the United States. In point of fact, the fines are almost exclusively the financial institutions that are exempt here and would, under the bill, be out from under the customer due diligence requirements that FinCEN's imposing. So I think this bill has it precisely backwards. And the other, I guess, thing is that it really is one of those many federal rules that create the appearance of action when in point of fact it's not really going to get anything done because it is so easy to evade. It's easy to evade legally because of the way it's drafted, and it would be easy to evade illegally because there's going to be no enforcement behind this unless we want to massively increase the budgets at FinCEN so they can actually conduct audits and enforcement. So this, I have to say, is one of the most wrong-headed ideas that I've seen the Republicans grab onto in at least a decade. Until November, this was something that only the far left of the Democratic Party supported. People like Senator Whitehouse or Carolyn Maloney. But in November, this suddenly got legs politically because Congressman Pierce dropped the discussion draft. And it's the kind of thing where they could potentially pass it with a Republican minority because the vast majority of Democrats will probably go along.
Clay, did you have anything to add?
I think my statement pretty much speaks for itself.
All right. Well, we can.
Or you want to go ahead and go to questions?
Oh no! You can finish your thought.
With concerns about, I don't know for sure, but I'm assuming this has become an issue with conservatives now today is because we're recognizing the national security implications of it. And as these come in, conservatives are typically concerned with national security issues as well as with creating a fair and level playing field economically for all actors. And I think that's what this draft bill is aimed at doing. And I see it as a way to not, I don't see it as a big burden on small businesses. And to address the targeting of small businesses, the reason why that is, I mean, the $5 million or the 20 employees thing, those are pretty much random numbers. I don't know who came up with that can be adjusted if needed for some reason. But the issue why they focused on small businesses is because larger businesses with bigger than $5 million receipts and more than 20 employees are typically publicly owned, or they're subject to all sorts of other rules that are already on the book that require them to disclose their beneficial owners. And so there's no need to require them to disclose what has already been disclosed to the public out of their basic structures.
There is virtually no such thing as a public company with only $5 million in receipts. The SEC estimates it costs $2.5 million in legal fees alone to go to become a public company. So your sense of scale is wrong. You have to be vastly bigger than that to be a public company. Plus, it exempts public companies. The only place where the gross receipts test is going to bite is for private companies. And it's the smallest companies. Again, people probably intuitively think, oh, we're going to exempt the small guys. No, it's the other way around. It only applies to the small guys.
Well, so my question would be, and what I keep coming back to with this is, with the cost and compliance burden, if a small company with less than 20 employees and less than $5 million in receipts has such a hard time figuring out who the ultimate beneficial owner is of their company, that might be a problem in itself. I mean, I know
as the example I gave, if you have
business owners who easily know who owns their company, and I understand what you're saying about venture capital too, as well, but there are venture capitalists out in California who are Russian, legit Russian investors, who wish that beneficial ownership legislation was in there so that they could verify to small startups that they're not part of a sanctioned list, that they're not some kind of front company investor, because small startups are refusing them because they have a Russian name and excluding them from the market because there's no way to verify who they are.
Well, it would be a problem in case of venture capital funds, small business investment corporations, any entity that is investing in an entrepreneur. And then you have to do the look through, and the entrepreneur is being obligated to report on its beneficial ownership when it has no legal means of compelling the investor to provide that information. And the investor may not even know it. I mean, a lot of SBICs are publicly traded. So they're exempt, but the entrepreneur that received the investment is supposed to report on the beneficial ownership of the SBIC. Venture capital funds are typically private but have a great many investors. And they're going to change regularly over the period of a year or two, and they're going to be required to report on that, even though the VC probably doesn't even know if they have entities investing in the VC. You have pension funds that make these kind of investments, which raises a whole other series of problems. This is not simple stuff. And you're asking the smallest businesses in America that don't have big compliance staffs to have to deal with it.
All righty. Well, let's go to audience questions now. Thank you both once again for those opening remarks. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. Looks like we have a question lined up already. Caller, feel free to ask your question.
Hi, this is Chris Garvey in New York. The income tax was regarded as inconsistent with the rights of free Englishmen when it was first introduced, and Jefferson bragged that in America, no individual farmer or small businessman had to deal with a tax man. So that the best way to get rid of the tax reporting problems would be to abolish the income tax and go back to a small revenue tariff. Instead of taxing our stuff that we make here at a much higher rate than at the stuff that comes in from China. As for prohibition, that's the cause of the opiate epidemic. That's the cause of the fentanyl getting into the bloodstreams of addicts and killing them. And as for abuse by the IRS, the bank reporting requirements give a tremendous amount of opportunity for the IRS to do things like confiscate the entire bank account of a restaurant that is required by their insurance company to put in deposits of no larger than $10,000, because the insurance company doesn't want to be liable for that stuff in their cash registers. And the IRS has taken the bank accounts, accusing of such restaurants of structuring their deposits by making them less than $10,000 so they don't have to comply with the deposit report requirements. Furthermore, Dodd-Frank has made it very difficult for small capitalization companies to seek Wall Street and public structure to their corporations, because the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act has made so many terrible reporting requirements that there are no new banks and new small companies starting up that are publicly offered to via Wall Street. And so all these regulations are piling up to cripple our economy, and the proposals by Clay are just seem to be adding to it and making it more advantageous to be a large corporation than a small corporation. And Mr. Clay might want to respond to all that stuff I just said.
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So I share your concern with the income tax. I've worked on that in previous research before, where I draw a direct correlation between capping the house at 435 and implementing the income tax. I don't like it. I agree with you completely that prohibition is what has caused the opioid crisis, but, you know, good luck convincing Congress or the executive or anybody to deal with that in a reasonable manner. You know, the DEA has failed since its inception at its mission, and that's largely where I get at my focus on illicit finance, because that's the best way to stop illegal behavior. I agree with you I have shared concerns about the piling up regulation, definitely with the IRS. I think I'm not an expert in Dodd-Frank or any of that. I'm not a domestic American economist. I work on foreign and defense policy. But if Dodd-Frank is preventing small companies from becoming publicly offered, then that's something that seems like a big problem to me that I think people should address. As for leaning towards giving big corporations more power, I hope that's not the case. That's not my intention in my support of this legislation at all. I actually believe that it will create a fairer, better market for small businesses by getting rid of nonprofit motivated actors out of the market. And if that needs to be done in a different way, then I'm completely open to hearing suggestions about it. And I think that's why the House has left this as a draft bill, because they're hoping that people will come to the table with constructive arguments to do this in a way that works for national security.
I might add two things. First off, one of the reasons you see the number of broker-dealers declining considerably, and basically small broker-dealers and small banks becoming less and less common, and the increasing concentration of deposits in large multinational banks, is the cost of AML compliance, and this basically would put that on steroids. So this would accentuate the problems that you identified. One, just point, you raised the question of the IRS piggybacking on the AML rules and the anti-structuring rules. There is a discussion draft in a Ways and Means Committee that was released about a week and a half ago, and the comment period on that ends today. That would address the structuring thing by making it much more difficult for the IRS to assert a structuring charge against a small business, and you might want to look at that.
Let's go to our next question. Caller, feel free to ask your question.
This is Jack Park, and I just have a question of clarity. Assume that I am a lawyer and set up a solo practice and incorporate. I'm definitely under 20 employees, and it'd be a miracle if I made $5 million. So that's a corporation newly formed. Would I have to do the reporting?
David, you want to answer that?
Yeah, the answer is unquestionably yes. The general rules it applies to everyone, and you would not fall in one of the exemptions because you have both under 5 million and under 20 or fewer employees, and only one of those has to be met before the reporting requirements would kick in.
So
thanks, Clay. How does that serve your purposes?
So the forms that I've been shown or seen require or that are proposed require your name, your address, and a personal identification number, like your driver's license number. And that's it.
Yeah, but I'd have to file it every year, right? With FinCEN?
No, you only have to file it when it changes.
Okay.
And in order to be in violation, you would have to knowingly and willingly be providing false information.
There's no mens rea requirement in this statute as drafted.
Well, if I listen to this teleforum, don't I have? Am I not knowingly violating it? I'm sorry, I'm being sarcastic, but thank you both.
All right, let's go to our next question. Caller, feel free to ask your question.
This is Robert Barker. I'm calling from Atlanta, too. And I got to say that I agree with both of you. You make both compelling arguments. It's kind of funny that you both disagree with each other so much, because I think there is a need for some sort of more identification in this country of who owns what. Any foreigner can walk into the country. Any Cypriot lawyer, any trust can form a Delaware corporation or any corporation in any state, quite frankly, without any acknowledgement of ownership. Simply, there's whoever the president or some officer might be identified in some states, but generally, corporations and trusts and other entities can be formed in this country without any of the kinds of reporting that goes on in a typical modern jurisdiction. I do see that as a problem. I am not in favor of a lot of reporting, but it seems to me that as Federalists, maybe we should consider whether or not if the states are forming these entities, maybe the states could take charge of finding out who owns the entities that they're forming. And to the extent that that reporting was done at the state level, there would be an exemption from requiring that kind of reporting at the federal level. That would make the information publicly available to anybody who needed to know it, including law enforcement, and maybe not in one registry, or it could be in one registry because the states could certainly cooperate to put it into one registry. But it strikes me as being overkill to try to make it a new federal requirement. And yes, Dodd-Frank has led to a decrease in the number of publicly traded companies, just as the Nazi regime that came into power in Germany led to a decrease in the number of publicly reporting companies as well in the 1930s. Because once you start confiscating the profits of a company and start making them comply with a lot of regulation, it does lead to a lack of new capital formation and investment in public entities. And Dodd-Frank has had that effect.
Well, on the question of the state versus federal, you've identified one of the relatively few differences between the original Democratic proposals and the Pierce discussion draft. Both of the Democratic proposals, although in the case of the Corporate Transparency Act, Senator Rubio has become a co-sponsor, would require this information be collected by the relevant state agency, which of course differs state by state, and then would provide federal money to compensate them for that. And in, if memory serves me, it's $40 million a year in those bills too. The actual number is available in the paper I wrote on this subject, if you want to track it down. But the long and short of it is that they would require the states initially, just on newly formed entities, and within 2 years, all corporate or LLCs, corporations or LLCs, to report this information. And because it's state level, and virtually every state has a public allows the public to view the information, it would be a public beneficial ownership database in each state. One of the reasons I think that Pierce went down the route of having FinCEN administer it was so that the database could be private. It also is just simpler because you have the federal government doing it, you have federal rules, and then Congress can presumably conduct some degree of oversight over FinCEN in a way they just never would be able to with 50 different state agencies plus D.C.
Let's go to our next. Oh, sorry.
Okay. No, go ahead.
I was going to move to the next caller, but if you had some further thoughts on this question, please feel free.
Sure, no.
All righty, let's go to the next caller. Caller, feel free to ask your question.
Hi, this is Andrew Siff. I just want to come back to some statements Mr. Fuller made because I guess I'm a bit confused about what bill text he's looking at. I'm looking at the text of the bill, the draft legislation on which a hearing was held, in the House Financial Services Subcommittee, that is the draft bill that I assume is being discussed. And when he says that, you know, first of all, as noted, obviously the bill as written applies not only to newly formed entities, but 2 years after it becomes effective, it applies to all existing entities. So if you have an existing law firm or corporation that isn't exempt, you have to start doing this. And I don't know how it can be read to say this only applies when there's a change. If you look at pages 18 and 19 of the bill, in addition to doing the initial filing, whether you're a new entity or once that kicks in for every existing corporation, LLC, it says that you have to file a new filing within 60 days of any change, not only in the identity of the beneficial owners, but in any of the change in any change in the address, name, or driver's license or passport number of a beneficial ownership owner that was already provided. In addition, there's an obligation to do an annual filing, even if nothing changed. It's an annual submission of the same thing. And going to the criminal penalties, what's hard about this is when you actually, again, read the bill text, it is not true that everything is knowing and willful. Some of the provisions are willful, but there is one that is knowing that says it, you know, you can be prosecuted for, quote, knowingly providing or attempting to provide false or fraudulent information. Now, there is another provision that says for willfully failing to update, But if in the first instance or at any time you provide false information, whether it's on an update or anything else, you can, you know, be subject to criminal law. And as groups ranging from the ACLU to Freedom Works to the American Bar Association and National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers have made clear, and every lawyer knows, I know Mr. Fuller isn't a lawyer, a knowing violation can be proven just by the fact that you provide information that happens to have been incorrect, whether the person intended to fully comply with the law or was even aware of the law. So I'm curious to know what text Mr. Fuller's looking at when he makes those statements, because as it was brought up at the early in the call, there are a lot of different versions about this. So when he says that so Mr. Fuller, I'm curious to know which text you're referring to when you say you only have to file it and you don't have to refile unless there's a change in the beneficial owner.
I'm looking at probably the same text that you have, and you know I share your concerns with that, and I'm not a lawyer, and I'm referring to many conversations I've probably had about how to change the draft legislation for certain aspects of that, and I've known since the beginning that that's been one issue. This compliance with the penalties for the law and how they're applied has been a big concern of many since the beginning. That, again, I'm not an expert in, but I'll tell you my sort of understanding of how the general thing works is that FinCEN typically doesn't investigate or verify the validity of this information. Typically, the swelling compliance departments at banks, and starting May 11th with the CDD rule comes down, it's on them to do that themselves. And if you read the guidance from FinCEN that came out on the 4th of this month, it's about 25 pages of guidance on how compliance departments are to go through and collect and verify and manage and store and everything on down the line for the beneficial ownership information that they have to collect on their customers.
You're talking about the guidance they put out on April 4th about the CDD rule that's coming into effect on May 11th?
Yes.
Okay, so that's a CDD rule. That's not this legislation.
Right.
Okay.
So that's how it's already working. So with this legislation, I think, and this is why it's a draft bill, and this is why it's important that I want to emphasize that I think we should work together on this to come up with a good solution that works before things change in Congress. But we need to work on that because there's a way for the compliance departments will already be managing all that. So a lot of this is already going on. So Congress needs to figure out what FinCEN's role is in managing that between the banks and themselves. And I don't have access to classified information. I have no security clearances. So I don't know how that works.
What are the forms you're referring to that you've been shown?
I've seen their propose like different proposals for beneficial ownership information
from agencies or from staff. Or?
No, as it lists it in the draft legislation.
Well, there aren't forms in the draft legislation.
Yeah.
No, I mean there's not form.
It lists that they want name, address, and identification number.
Yeah, and then it says you have to update it within 60 days of a change occurring, not being aware of a change.
Right, I believe.
On direct and indirect beneficial owners.
Okay. So
While seeing no questions lined up, just like to give a brief reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for Friday, April 13th. That call will be a Teleform on the 10th anniversary of the Heller case and the original meaning of the Second Amendment. It will be featuring Professors Nelson Lund and Daryl Miller, and featuring moderator Robert Leiter. You can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleform conference calls on the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleform calls you may have missed. Not seeing any more questions lined up for our speakers, if you would like to have any concluding remarks.
I guess just the in terms of sort of where we are state of play-wise, I know that Chairman Henschling wants to try to get a BSA reform bill done before he leaves Congress, which will be at the end of this year. So it's likely that we'll see, at least in the House, some kind of BSA reform bill, which, of course, is desirable. The thing we've been talking about is Section 9 of the discussion draft, which would impose this beneficial ownership reporting. There's also, I mean, the banks want this to happen before the May 11th CDD rules come into force. So there's some reason to believe that they will attempt to move this within the next month. And there's also been some movement in the Senate, but I think that's a little bit more problematic. But there's been a hearing on this in judiciary, not banking. And it's possible that this would start to try to move there, but it doesn't have the kind of support that it seems to have in House Financial Services, where you have subcommittee chairman pushing it. So
I would just say that I feel this is a very strong national security imperative, and it seems very clear to me that this is a good bipartisan chance to actually do something about reforming the BSA-AML regime and doing something about getting bad actors out of our economy, which is where a lot of the future conflict and problems are going to come from. And so I think this will take some working together from all sides to come up with something that's a good American solution, a democratic capitalist solution that will, you know, make America's markets more efficient and strengthen our security.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for their benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.